let us now praise famous men. The Lord hath wrought great glory by them through his great power from the beginning. Such as did bear rule in their kingdoms, men renowned for their power, giving counsel by their understanding and declaring prophecies, leaders of the people by their counsels, and by their knowledge of learning meet for the people, wise and eloquent in their instructions. All these were honored in their generations and were the glory of their times. There be of them that have left a name behind them, that their praises might be reported. And some there be which have no memorial, who are perished as though they had never been, and are become as though they had never been born, and their children after them. But these were merciful men whose righteousness hath not been forgotten. With their seed shall continually remain a good inheritance, and their children are within the covenant. Their seed standeth fast, and their children for their sakes. Their seed shall remain forever, and their glory shall not be blotted out. Their bodies are buried in peace, but their name liveth forevermore. The people will tell of their wisdom, and the congregation will show forth their praise. Amen.
the word that Isaiah the son of Amos saw. And it shall come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills. And all nations shall flow unto it, and many peoples shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge between the nations, and shall decide for many peoples. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Behold my servant whom I uphold, mine elect in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him. He shall make the right to go forth to the nations. He shall not cry nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break, and a dimly burning wick shall he not quench. He shall make the right to go forth according to the truth. He shall not fail nor be crushed till he have set the right in the earth, and the isles shall wait for his teaching. Grant us peace, thy most precious gift, O thou eternal source of peace, and enable Israel to be a messenger of peace unto the peoples of the earth. Bless our country that may ever be a stronghold of peace and its advocate in the council of nations. May contentment reign within its borders, health and happiness within its homes. Strengthen the bonds of friendship and fellowship among the inhabitants of all lands. Plant virtue in every soul, and may the love of thy name hallow every home and every heart. Praised be thou, O Lord, giver of peace. Amen. My dear friends, we are met in this sanctuary this morning to pay memorial tribute to a noble and courageous citizen of the world, a man rich in faith and in faithfulness, who lived and died in the service of human brotherhood and international peace. Dag Hammarskjöld, as Secretary General of the United Nations, held sacred the high office which was entrusted to him. He was firm, impartial, and unafraid. He was a responsible and trustworthy leader in confused and desperate times. Not everyone agreed with him at all times, but no one could question his integrity or the motives of his actions. No one, except those who would have him do that which the responsibility of his office and his own clear conscience forbade. I personally recall the Suez Affair of 1956. Mr. Hammarskjöld was vigorously carrying out the United Nations resolution calling for the withdrawal of the military forces of Great Britain, France, and Israel from Egypt and the Suez. Many of us felt at the time that this action was unwise. Many of us still think so today. But it was a decision, a resolution of the United Nations. When I was asked at the time by the White House to contact Prime Minister Ben-Gurion of Israel and urge him to comply with the resolution of the United Nations, I did so, although reluctantly and with a heavy heart, knowing of the many harassments to which Nasser had been subjecting Israel and his avowed determination to destroy it. I disagreed with Mr. Hammarskjöld's judgment, but I respected the sincerity and the honesty of his convictions. He was acting in conformity with his best judgment and with what he believed to be the dictates of the Charter of the United Nations. Israel, France, Great Britain, as you will recall, complied. Even the Russians applauded him at that time. But when a few years later the Congo crisis developed, and Mr. Amershul was again carrying out a resolution of the United Nations, one which this time ran counter to the interest of the Soviet Union, Mr. Khrushchev, you will recall, bitterly denounced him and demanded his resignation. Mr. Amershul, he cried, sided with the colonialists and with the countries that supported the colonialists. Mr. Amershul, of course, refused to resign. It is easy to resign, he said. And how true that is. Men of principle and character do not abandon their posts because of attack or of calumny. Mr. Amershul supported no colonialism and no imperialism, only the United Nations, its high ideals and objectives, and he supported it with complete faithfulness and impartiality. Men like him, dear friends, are the hope of the world. Only men like him can guide the nations of the world through the dangerous conflicts and rivalries which threaten our civilization. Such men as Dag Hammarskjöld are rare indeed. But they do vindicate our humanity, and they do restore our faith in the future of our society. We are honored this morning to have as our guest and as our speaker at this memorial tribute to Mr. Amershul, the President of the American Association for the United Nations, Mr. Clark M. Eichelberger. Mr. Eichelberger has been a friend and champion of the United Nations ever since its establishment at San Francisco in 1945, which he attended. He has been as close to the work of the United Nations as anyone in our country. And he has used his great gifts of heart and mind through the medium of the written and the spoken word to rally the support of the American people behind the United Nations. It is an honor and a privilege for me to present Mr. Clark M. Eichelberger.
Rabbi Silver, in the circumstances that were less somber than the occasion for this morning, I would tell you how much I appreciate the honor of speaking in your temple to your congregation and other citizens of Cleveland. I would extend greetings to one sitting with us who served in the United States delegations, the United Nations, and saw Amershul intimately as only a member of our delegation could, or the distinguished diplomatic representative of his country. I think, certainly, I speak for myself, and I believe it's true for many that I've shared experiences with this last week. People have been thinking very much since Hammarskjöld's death of immortality. Of immortality of the soul and the immortality of man's work on earth. Dag Hammarskjöld was a very complex, and shall I say, a magnificent character. He was a man of great physical courage. He'd go anywhere in the world where duty called him. Communists trying to get the American prisoners back. Laos. His last act of physical courage, and he lost his life. He was a man of great moral courage as well. I remember when Trygve Lie retired and Hammarskjöld took his place. People said, well, now Trygve Lie may not have been a man of great subtlety, but he showed great courage in finding the Russians were through with him. Now, Hammarskjöld begins as a man who is very clear, wants to serve all parties to the United Nations. He's a man very intelligent. He'll work very hard. But if another Korean issue should arise, would he have courage? Some years went on before that courage was tested. And then it was shown that he had great moral as well as physical courage, that he would withstand, resist, and fight back any attack made upon the institution of the United Nations or the sanctity of his office. He was a man of great intellectual attainments. He had great intellectual affinity for other great characters. I know for illustration, as Rabbi Silvers pointed out, his frequent disagreements with Ben-Gurion, particularly over Suez. Yet Hammarskjöld told me himself one time of the great intellectual affinity he felt for that great intellectual leader of Israel. He climbed mountains. He translated plays. He loved music. He was a highly civilized person. I don't think anyone, there was enough inscrutability about him, and I doubt if he confided in anyone intimately how deeply he might have felt about whether the tragedies faced him, or tragedies that he rather met somewhat gloriously, as more extrovert fighters can. I had just a little inkling of how he might have felt just the day that before he left for the Congo. I had returned from Geneva attending a meeting of the World Federation of United Nations Associations. There are United Nations Associations in some 50 countries, and I was there with a delegation representing our association in the United States. And obviously, it would be expected that the Soviet Association delegates came forth with a resolution on the Troika principle. And then there were some people there who didn't come from the Iron Curtain countries, but who nevertheless had not been personally friendly to Mr. Hammarskjöld in the assembly. And I fought, and I thought a pretty good battle for the principles of the sanctity of the Secretariat, and how foolish it would be to divide the world into three artificial ideological divisions. And so I was having lunch with some of my staff in the delegates' dining room. And there was Mr. Hammarskjöld with Andrew Cordier. The staff said, look, he's leaving for the Congo tonight. Go tell him about the fight you just made on behalf of the Secretariat. And I hated to bother him, but I intruded. And I told him about it. And he smiled and he said, well, you seem to enjoy the fight. And I said, doesn't one always enjoy a fight on the side of the right? And he smiled. I've been thinking over that smile ever since. This was just literally a few hours before he lost his life. He's going to his last great adventure. Did he face those things somewhat gaily? Or did he face them as a retiring and cultured man has to fight responsibilities that his youth, possibly, he never anticipated? Well, the news on a Monday morning was that Hammarskjöld's plane was lost. My office is across the street from the United Nations building. I listened to the radio broadcasts. I kept looking out of the window. Then I saw the guards come out, put the United Nations flag at half-mast, and I knew that the news of his death had been confirmed. Then there came over me this feeling that all of this intelligence, this courage, all that he represented, could not be finally destroyed, could not be snuffed out in a broken body in a near jungle in northern Rhodesia. His death, if I may intrude a personal word, has confirmed to me as nothing has in years my faith in the immortality of the soul. But you and I must be concerned with the immortality of the living. We must be concerned with the only way in which we can give him immortality on earth. That is to see that his ideas are carried forward. The ideas of a society of free nations based on law. I've listened to a great many speeches at the United Nations in the last 10 days. For the first day, there was complete shock. People were distraught. And many of our newspaper and radio commentators were saying, can this be the end? Will the United Nations possibly survive? And then as days went on, courage asserted itself, and a certain spirit of defiance on the part of some of the delegates, saying that they would insist on maintaining the integrity of the Secretariat and the strengthening of the United Nations so that his ideals might be perpetuated, the living monument of the United Nations. Now, Hammarskjöld left two very great documents. As one reads them over, they are documents so great that one would almost think that if he didn't know better, that there must have been some great awareness of impending tragedy, and he wanted to leave a great testament. One was a meeting he had in the assembly hall, I believe it was on the 8th of September, for the staff. Now, obviously, a staff of some 5,000 people, drawn from all nationalities, is a more difficult staff to address than if you're talking to the staff of your own institution in a single country as the United States. So he had to talk about staff matters, and the head of the staff committee had to talk about salaries and promotions and many things. And it isn't easy to memorize his quotation because, remember, Hammarskjöld was constantly being forced to think and talk in either English or French, which he did very well, but sometimes his sentences were more complex than I presume they would have been in his native language. But he went on to warn the staff of the great crisis that was coming in the United Nations over whether they should carry on the tradition of an independent secretariat or whether the secretariat would soon become the servant of the great powers and ideological blocs. But then he went on to discuss the great reward that comes to a person for service. And he appealed to them to find satisfaction granting decent working conditions, the satisfaction that comes to a man if he serves many or if he serves a few. And I think a few sentences of that testament will be quoted by people under many different circumstances as the satisfaction that one gets from serving his fellow men in a great cause, whether or not he is certain that that cause will prevail in his lifetime. But the other testament that I want to speak about for a few minutes this morning was the introduction to his report to the 16th General Assembly. Now, the Secretary General always writes an introduction to his report, which, as Congressman Bolton will agree, is a very tremendous volume. The introduction usually gives the philosophy of the Secretary General and his review of the previous year. But Hammarskjöld went deeper into the division between the two sides in this ideological struggle over the United Nations. And he went deeper in what the Charter of the United Nations can mean. I think that students of government, students of the development of international institutions of the United Nations, will be going back and back and back to this introductory report of his as one of the most important things written on the United Nations. Now, Hammarskjöld really began by pointing out that there were two philosophies regarding the United Nations. One was the philosophy that the United Nations was simply a conference mechanism between ideological blocks in order to achieve a degree of coexistence between ideological blocks that would remain militarily prepared, and as best, an uneasy coexistence between these three blocks. A division of the world into three artificial divisions. And then obviously, such a concept would take all the institutions of the United Nations and reduce them to a simple conference mechanism. And the Secretariat would lose its independence and its character. Then he pointed out that there is the other philosophy, which begins with the conference method, of course, because men must confer. But a method that goes on to consider that the members of the United Nations will establish institutions of an independent character for the organization itself. Now, we said that in the beginning, Dag Hammarskjöld enjoyed a very considerable immunity. Many people used to speculate how long it would be before the Russians were after him, because he could count on the nations of the West, who, mind, as Rabbi Silver said, disagree with on particular instances, but their sense of history, their sense of fair play, their sense of building in institutions would mean that they would disagree, but go on nevertheless. Whereas to the Soviet Union, to those imbued with the philosophy of dialectic materialism, there is only one truth at the moment, and only one situation that's tolerable, and only one man that's acceptable, that is those that agree with him. And consequently, the time came when the Soviet Union would have nothing more of him. And you have seen and you've heard his voice. It's been rebroadcast many times as he sat there in the General Assembly after Mr. Khrushchev had said that if he were a man of courage, he would resign. Hammarskjöld said it would be very easy to resign. It takes courage to stay against the opposition of a great power. But as long as the small states, the different from the great powers, had no defense whatsoever but the protection of the United Nations, he would stay on as long as they wanted him to. And you have heard and have seen the pictures of the tremendous applause and the pounding on the table of the Soviet bloc. So he enjoyed an immunity for a long time. And the break came, of course, over the Congo, when he challenged the Soviet Union for its giving military aid, or intruding military aid in the Congo on behalf of one faction or another, while pretending to go along with the United Nations resolutions. Well, Mr. Hammarskjöld, in his report, has a vision of the United Nations that I wish we would think of, and I wish we could read and read that report. He points out that the preamble of the Charter reaffirms faith in equal rights for men and women and for nations large and small. to him, that marks the difference between the United Nations and a League of States. Because the United Nations is concerned in the very beginning with equal rights for men and women, as well as for nations large and small. Then along with that, he speaks of the program, the charter for human rights and fundamental freedoms without distinction. That brings with it economic cooperation and a desire for economic justice. Because again, he points out that the charter is concerned not simply with the economy of nations, but with the economy of individuals within the nations. He finds the thread of United Nations concern with the individual all through the charter more clearly than anyone has ever written. And then he points out that in addition to the charter, guarantee speaking of equal rights for men and women as well as nations great and small, and a message of economic help to all people. Then he speaks of the program that the charter outlines for nations for the prevention of war, for the maintenance of law. And his third principle is that the United Nations stands for the development of law. Well, obviously the United Nations cannot stand for enhancing the dignity of the individual and economic benefits for all people, and for the establishment of law among nations, if the United Nations is to be a conference mechanism simply to provide coexistence between three ideological blocks. And then he points out that the United Nations is going beyond a town meeting place or a diplomatic conference, that both the Security Council and the General Assembly particularly are developing as parliamentary bodies, and that recommendations of the General Assembly, because they carry a greater and greater consensus of nations, become not only recommendations, but decisions that nations are inclined to follow. Then he discusses, in very impersonal terms, his own tragedy. That is, that the United Nations does not provide precise executive authority. The charter does not provide adequate executive authority in the organization itself. The Security Council and the General Assembly are forced to take great decisions involving Korea, involving the Congo, involving Suez. But then they must turn to the Secretary General to recruit a fleet of vessels to clear the Suez Canal. The Secretary General to recruit an international army for the Gaza Strip or for the Congo. And so there have been conciliation teams and presences and all sorts of manifestations of the United Nations all over the world. From a simple presence in a simple Mideastern country, one man there to guarantee the integrity of that country, to an international army somewhere. Time and time again, these bodies of the United Nations would leave it up to the Secretary General to implement their decisions. Time and time again, he'd have to go back to them for clarification, because sometimes their resolutions were very vague in order to get enough unanimity so the resolution could pass. Now, there are those people who have said that the Secretary General assumed too much authority. If he hadn't assumed great authority, our world would have fallen down on the Congo, and the Cold War would now be in Africa, and possibly a hot war by this time. But the Secretary General, time and time again, warned the nations that they must be willing to take greater responsibility themselves, not expect him to do it beyond a certain point. Well, President Kennedy said in his address before the General Assembly a week ago that what we do in the next 8 months may well determine the fate of mankind for the next 3,000 years. Possibly he's the first president of the United States that could have made such a statement. All the forces of our time, of the human and scientific revolution, massed to present this assembly with the greatest array of problems that have ever been before a parliamentary body. We can incinerate the earth, we can have a nuclear catastrophe, or we can build permanent peace, and the decisions may be taken in the next 8 months. The world will greatly miss Hammarskjöld. What is the reason? You probably saw that. I heard over the radio that when Hammarskjöld was buried in that great ceremony, that there was one simple wreath of flowers from his family. And on that wreath, there was one word, why? We can't give the answer. We can try to find in all of our scripture, in all of our religious faith, the answer, why? But one thing we can answer, that the ideals for which he stood and for which he gave his life will be enshrined in an expanding United Nations. I would conclude by saying that the United States, that we American people are in that peculiar situation, or possibly what we do, more than any other people, will determine whether or not we can give him immortality on earth.
Oh.
the privilege of reading the following telegram, which was received by the temple from Gunnar Jarring, Ambassador of Sweden to the United States. Please convey the following message to your congregation at the memorial service for Mr. Hammarskjöld. These days, men and women of all groups and races, of all creeds and denominations, join hands and bow their heads, mourning the death of Dag Hammarskjöld, a soft-spoken but deeply dedicated soldier of peace fallen on active duty. For any Swede, it is a great heartwarming experience to see how Dag Hammarskjöld's work stirred the imagination of people of goodwill all over the world. We Swedes are happy to join hands with Dag Hammarskjöld's friends in other countries in a pledge to carry on the all-important fight for peace to which he dedicated his life. Signed, Gunnar Jarring, Ambassador of Sweden. The temple is honored to have the distinguished men and women who join with us on our pulpit, who have come to honor this champion of the international understanding, and especially to express by their presence the encouragement of those who continue his work. Congresswoman Frances P. Bolton, Mr. Wright Bryan, the editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Mr. Einar G. Carlson, the Swedish Vice Consul, Mr. Neil J. Carruthers, the Executive Director of the University Circle Foundation, His Honor Anthony J. Celebrezzi, the Mayor of our city, Dr. Zelma George, former member of the delegation of the United States to the United Nations, Dr. T. Keith Glennon, President of Case Institute of Technology, Dr. William B. Levinson, Superintendent of the Cleveland Public School System, Mr. Leo W. Newmark, President of the Jewish Community Federation, Mr. Donald Stofflet, Vice President of Western Reserve University, and Mr. Paul Walter, President of the World Federalists. And now may I ask all of us to rise for a closing benediction. O Lord our God, as this hour of tribute closes and we retire to our several pursuits, we pray that the memory of nobility may long walk with us. In the troubled days ahead, we will have need of the example of such strength and faith. We will do well to admit and to abide his insistence that narrow ambition be abandoned, that polite manners be replaced by a broad humanity, and that stubborn adherence to principle take the place of empty words. The hour is late. Storm clouds of fearful proportion threaten. As he admitted setback but never defeat, so may we steel ourselves against rude buffeting and draw close our common assurance that the day will come when every man will sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make him afraid. Boachem b'shalom, tzeischem b'shalom. As your coming was for peace, so may your going be for peace.